Well, good morning. Good morning, one and all. And if you're able to, it'd be nice if you could turn on your video so I could see your face. And if not, that's fine too. Well, thank you so much for showing up on such a beautiful day. I was thinking of skipping myself, but then I had to do the talk, so I couldn't do that. Oh. Well, as I think everyone knows, we're kind of entering into what we're calling a praxis intensive with the Calgary Soto Sangha, and we're talking about looking at examining life koans, the kind of questions, issues that life presents us. And these koans, these things that life gives us, don't really have the kind of answer that we would like. We would like the answer and then be done with it. But life doesn't work that way. Often there is no answer that will kind of finish the koan. But the koan nevertheless is resolved. Resolved perhaps in how we live our life, resolved in how we approach it, the kind of wisdom, compassion that we bring forward. So today, I'd like us to consider how we meet the koan of failure. How do we meet the koan of failure? I wonder, what was your first memory of failure? I think we all have one or two strong ones. My first painful memory of failure took place in grade 2. I wanted to join the school choir. But at the first meeting, the music teacher felt there were far too many of us who wanted to join. So she lined us up in groups of about 7 and had us sing some simple song. I can't remember what it was. Maybe, you know, B-I-N-G-O, B-I-N-G-O. Bingo was his name. Some kind of little song like that. Well, she walked slowly by, kind of listening with one ear for about 5 seconds to each of us. And I didn't make the cut. In those 5 seconds, my hope to join the choir ended. I failed. So like all of us, I probably had many failures before then, before that grade 2 experience, but that was my first memory of a really painful failure. And of course, many countless experiences of failure since then. But I've come to see, you know, failure is quite confusing and it's quite complex. A failure happens slowly, sometimes gradually gathering momentum. And failure also happens in the blink of an eye. All kinds of things, right? You didn't ask for help. You let someone you love down. You failed to plan in advance. You bit off more than you could chew. Perhaps you forgot something important, or you froze at the meeting. So many ways that we can fail. So many possibilities to fail. And then, of course, after comes that kind of repeating tape of what you should have done, what you shouldn't have done, what you should have said, what you shouldn't have said. And we chew on that in kind of a bitter apple that we chew on. And if that's not enough, perhaps we then consider that failure simply reinforces the meaning, the absolute meaning, that I'm simply not talented enough, or competent enough, or confident enough or smart enough, or I just don't have the right stuff. The right stuff, like those seven pilots recruited to become the Mercury astronauts. Maybe some of you are too young to remember the Mercury astronauts. But maybe you saw the movie, The Right Stuff. If you saw that movie, The Right Stuff, that's what it was about. And fail enough, and fail hard enough, you may decide not to try at all. Because to try is to open the yawning cavern of failure, of painful separateness. Because that's what failure often evokes in us, right? We are separate, cut off. Tachyphobia, the fear of failing, I think touches all of us at some time in our life. And for some of us, it lives in our house all the time, the fear of failure. So it is true, in failing, we miss the boat somehow. And yet, in failing, a Dharma gate suddenly appears. Suddenly, a Dharma gate is present, challenging our deepest sense of self and opening us to possibilities. I think failure is actually a most important part of our Zen practice. Because when you truly fail, at that moment you stop relating to our practice, your practice, as something that's going to get you somewhere, as something that you are doing. And this is because in our practice, in the midst of failure, like mind wandering off again, fantasy arising, past memories popping up as you sit, in the midst of failure, if you continue to practice rather than giving up and throwing the whole thing out the window, then practice becomes your life in a very powerful way. Over the years, I have introduced many, many people to meditation practice, to our Zazen practice. And when first beginning a meditation practice, I think as you all know, the most difficult obstacle to overcome is the relentless failure that we experience. Zazen is one place we can become intimate with failure. And we can learn to simply be with failure. Many beginners, of course, come to the Zendo because they want calm, they want ease of heart, because they've read this is what meditation brings, and boy, they sure would like some of that. But for most, when they sit down in the Zendo, they experience for the first time, perhaps, how scattered their mind is and how... And regardless how hard they try, they inevitably get lost in thought, judgments, memories, emotions. And some people become very frustrated with themselves because it's not what they expected. Failure so fast and so obvious, and then being confronted with that experience, some beginners think, well, meditation is not for me. I can't do it. And although they may not say this in words, I suspect they feel in some way they have failed. So how do we meet failure? What Dharma gate does it offer? Well, I'd like to bring up for our consideration a traditional koan, one that I think will help us approach our own koan of failure. And this comes from the Wumenguan, or the Gateless Gate, the Mumonkan. I'll read you the koan first. Once, in the old days, in the time of the world-honored one, meaning Buddha, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a young woman remained, sitting in samadhi, close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." So Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers once, took her to the Brahman heaven, exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of her deep meditation, but all in vain. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva, delusive wisdom. He will be able to rouse her from her samadhi." Instantly, the Bodhisattva of delusive wisdom emerged from the earth, made a bow to the world-honored one who made his request to wake up the woman. The Bodhisattva went over to the woman, snapped his fingers once, and at this she came out of her samadhi. There's a verse following this what they call the case. The verse goes like this. One was successful, the other not. Both secure freedom of mind. One in a god mask, one in a devil mask. Even in failure, a beautiful performance. Even in failure, a beautiful performance. This koan focuses on failure. And that's really unusual because most koans, it seems, focus on success, right? Someone becomes awakened or enlightened, another one gets deep understanding. But koans are often not what they seem to be upon first reading. Or rather, maybe it's better to say they offer layers of meaning. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this, using a different story here, a different koan. There's a very famous story, and again, this is also in the same collection as this one, The Gateless Gate. And this one goes like this. In ancient times, when the world-honored one was at Vulture Peak, the Buddha... Vulture Peak, which is located near the capital of Magadha in ancient India, the Buddha held up a flower, twirled it, and showed it to the assembly. At this, they all remained silent. Only the venerable Mahakashapa broke into a smile. At that time, 1,200 people were assembled, including monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. And we're told in this story, in this koan, no one understood except for Mahakashapa, the world. And at that point, the world-honored one said, "I have the eye treasury of the true Dharma, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of no form, the subtle gate of the Dharma. It does not depend on letters, being specially transmitted outside all teachings. I now entrust Mahakashapa with this." Well, Mahakashapa won the prize, it seems, right? This is a story of the success for Mahakashapa, who understood the Buddha's gesture of holding up the flower. But what about the other 1,000 199 people assembled there. Did they fail? Well, I think they also attained something very precious. I think they received the question. Probably each one formulated it a little differently, but maybe the question was, what is this? Holding up the flower. What was that, that powerful moment? And as we all know, and I think I've mentioned in an earlier talk, questions have a power that answers lack. Perhaps at that moment they were introduced to what we call don't know mind. That mind that can rest in deep inquiry. And that deep inquiry itself is a profound Dharma gate. What is this? Shinju Suzuki Roshi called this beginner's mind rather than don't know mind, but I think it was the same thing. Yes, Mahakashapa received a transmission, but many of those other 1,199 people received a don't know mind. So we can ask, who succeeded? Who failed? But let's go back to the main koan here. I have personally great sympathy for Manjushri. He just gets to the party and finds out everyone has already left or is leaving. Did he forget the time? Did his car break down on the way? Or were the Buddhas and other Bodhisattvas kind of pulling a joke at his expense, deliberately making sure that he was told to arrive when everyone else was just saying their goodbyes or leaving? Perhaps you have had an experience like Manjushri's, arriving late, feeling awkward or out of place, whether it was your own fault or not. And yet there's more in this story. Here is a young woman sitting near the Buddha, a closer seat than Manjushri's. And of course, as you all know, rank and hierarchy were and are highly respected, both in ancient Chinese culture, but it's also true in Japan today. Rank and hierarchy are very important. In Japan, guests and important people, for example, are considered to be somewhere near the top of any hierarchy. And so when a group of people gather at a traditional Japanese restaurant, the most important people, or person rather, is asked to sit right in front of the alcove, or the tokonoma, of the room. And in traditional Japanese rooms, there's always a small kind of alcove place where there's usually a scroll hanging in a flower arrangement or a little piece of art of some kind. Anyway, it's the seat of honor. And many, many times I saw people trying to refuse the seat of honor in an effort to sit at a more humble position, a humbler position. And both Kate and I had that experience ourselves because, you know, as foreign guests, you're often given the seat of honor. We have to go, oh, no, I couldn't possibly. Let me sit here near the bathroom, you know, so, I don't know, somewhere of words. But no, you're forced to sit, and that becomes your duty to take the seat of honor. Anyway, so here we have Manjushri Bodhisattva representing the highest attainment of wisdom. he is the very symbol or avatar of wisdom in our tradition, right? The Zen tradition. In Zendos around the world, traditionally, his statue or picture occupies the center place of the altar. And it's pretty easy to identify statues of Manjushri because he carries a sword of wisdom to cut through delusion and ignorance. And he's often depicted riding on a tiger, or pardon me, on a lion. Perhaps telling us taming the mind, taming the heart is like riding or subduing a ferocious lion. It takes great skill and careful effort. And in some sutras, he's also the teacher of Buddhas. In fact, there's a few sutras that referred to Manjushri as the teacher of seven Buddhas before Buddha. So he's pretty high up there. And yet in this koan, Manjushri seems rather like a prig, concerning about his position in the seating order. Why is this young woman sitting so close to you and I cannot approach? But here too, you know, I have sympathy for Manjushri. Not only is he late, or maybe he was never invited in the first place, we're not sure, but he's given a lowly position to sit. And here, this young woman has passed him by and sitting close to the Buddha. Quite a slight to his dignity. But can you identify a little with Manjushri here? Don't we all want to be special? To be noticed, to be welcome into the inner circle, to have skills and abilities that others will admire, to be respected? I know for myself in my early years, particularly in my late teens, early 20s, I wanted to be popular and included, to be the one who knew stuff, to at least for once in my life, to be the life of the party, to be able to tell the jokes and make everyone laugh. But not infrequently, I felt more like an outsider, kind of a bit of a loser, someone on the side, a bit of a failure. And that seemed to me at that time to be the worst possible thing. And so I tended to avoid parties. I tended to avoid taking risks. Maybe out of his frustration or self-doubt, Manjushri says to the Buddha, "Why can this young woman get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Now, I think as most of you know, throughout Asian history, women have always had inferior status compared to the men. In the Vinaya, for example, which comes out of India, the traditional rules for monks and nuns, a monk should never touch a woman. He should never be even in the presence of a woman without a fellow monk. And yet here is the Buddha with a young woman sitting very near and probably in the seat that Manjushri may be thinking he should be in. So the Buddha said, bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself. I think here it's interesting. The Buddha doesn't answer Manjushri directly. But like a good teacher, tells him to find out for himself. And so, back to the koan. Manjushri walked around the young woman three times, snapped his fingers once, nothing happened, took her up to the Brahman heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but all in vain. So here we have Manjushri. He's exerted all his powers, both his natural and his supernatural, to try bring this woman out of her deep samadhi, her deep meditation. But she remains calmly unaware of him and deeply absorbed. And then the Buddha says, even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva, delusive wisdom. He will be able to arouse her from her samadhi. And instantly, the Bodhisattva of delusion, of delusive wisdom, appears from the earth, made a bow to the world-honored one, who then made his request. And the Bodhisattva went over to the woman, snapped his fingers once, and at this she came out of her samadhi. Well, how galling for poor Manjushri. He failed. Even the great Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, fails, just like we all do. In the Zen tradition, as I said earlier, I think failure is an important aspect of practice. Failure is a Dharma gate, if it is clean failure. And clean failure is without the usual stickiness of self-recrimination. In the Zen tradition, we cultivate the understanding that failure is the way forward. We practice not trying to avoid it. For example, when training in traditional Zen temples, young monks and nuns are regularly rotated into different temple positions throughout the time that they stay at the temple. So sometime you'll be the guest master, sometime you'll be the cook, sometime you'll be in charge of organizing the garden cleaning, sometimes you're just cleaning the toilets, sometimes you're going to be the administrator in charge of finances. But here's the rub. You're not told in detail how to fulfill the duties. You're not given a manual. You simply are told to do it. Now, hopefully you've observed very carefully as you've done other duties, but you just have to do it. They learn through failure to a large degree. And while I'm sure it's quite painful at times, the learning is very deep, a kind of bodily learning as you go through these various positions. And I believe that this kind of failure, this kind, what I call clean failure, helps us see that the line between failure and success is much blurrier than our instincts would have us believe. Pema Chodron, the American Tibetan Buddhist nun and author, wrote a piece that she called Fail, Fail Again, Fail Better. I think she gave it as a speech at graduation, some university, a graduation speech. And she took her title, or developed her title, from a quote of Samuel Beckett's, which has the line, ever tried, ever failed. No matter, try again, fail better. Let me read that one more time, this Samuel Beckett's. Ever tried, ever failed. No matter, try again, fail better. Pema Chodron wrote in this piece, fail better means you begin to have the ability to hold the rawness of vulnerability in your heart and see it as your connection with other human beings, as part of your humanness. So she tells us our challenge is to hold the rawness of vulnerability without giving ourselves the label of loser or failure, kind of, you know, tattooed across our forehead. Failure can not only be our source of growth, our way of learning. But something that loosens the tenacious sense of I and me. With practice, Pema Chodron writes, we come to understand that failure, just like love, connects us to all human beings. It is part of what it means to be human. When we fail cleanly, we don't self-sabotage. We just keep on with our life and our practice. But again, if we fail cleanly, perhaps there's less of me doing it. Just go forward. And I think there's no better place to realize this than on a cushion. Well, doing Zazen, of course, we kind of hone the skill of mindfulness, the ability to notice with some clarity, kind of moment-to-moment changes in our experience. And when our mind wanders and we get lost in thought or emotion, then we know, oh, we're no longer really mindful, we're just kind of drifting along. But the moment we realize that we're lost in thought, that moment is a moment of mindfulness. And we return to the present moment. We return to the experience as it is. So, thus, each time we recognize that we're lost in thought is, in truth, a success. The failure itself, the noticing of the failure, we could say, is our success. Without the failure, there could be no success. It's not that we stop our thoughts in our practice. It is just a returning to awareness of the present moment. And with time, we come to see that rather than me doing this practice, it just seems the practice is doing practice. Failure leads to an intimacy with practice. In that intimacy, then, there is no one trying to steer it all the time, to make the corrections all the time. It's just practice. Zenke Blanche Hartman was an abbess of San Francisco Zen Center from 1996 to 2002. And she's now one of our Zen ancestors. She passed away, I think, 2 years ago. But when she was starting her practice, she had great trouble quieting her mind. And then one day she felt she had succeeded. And she wondered, oh, what should I do next? So she went to see her teacher, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, right? San Francisco Zen Center. And told him she was doing Zazen pretty well. And what should I do next? Suzuki Roshi shouted at her, Zazen does Zazen. You don't do Zazen. And that is the secret of practice. We come to understand it's not me doing it. Failing without the stickiness of our stories brings us close to our life, exactly as it is. Okay, so let's go back to the koan again. Manjushri seems in the koan to be bested by the bodhisattva of delusive wisdom. A bodhisattva at the very beginning stage of bodhisattvahood, right? He's a beginner. The young woman is in a deep samadhi, a state of unity or oneness, which is all very well and good. But what about this world? What about the fentanyl crisis, the plastics in the ocean, the warming climate, the crying child, the hungry young man begging in front of your favorite coffee shop, those seeking security and peace in their lives. What about all that? What about the everyday suffering and confusion that is so prevalent and close? In deep samadhi, while it can be very instructive and very nourishing, we cannot heal the world. And Manjushri represents the powerful wisdom of emptiness, right? That everything is open without limits and therefore one. So in a sense, this young woman is already intimate with what Manjushri can offer. And the World Honored One recognizes that. He says even 100,000 Manjushris cannot wake her up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva delusive wisdom. He'll be able to rouse her from her samadhi. And the Bodhisattva appears, walks over to the woman, snaps his finger once, and at this she came out of her samadhi. The Bodhisattva delusive wisdom coming out of the bowels of the earth represents for us, I think, the myriad things of the world. He's very close to the lowly. He's very close to the dukkha of our lives. He's close to this world of form. And with a snap of his fingers, he brings the young woman out of her state of samadhi. The sound of his fingers snapping is like the cries of the world. The young woman awakens to engage in the messiness of this life, to offer whatever she can. Now, this is what I find moving about this koan. There's lots of things I find moving, but here's one aspect. In this vast Buddhist universe that is described here, populated by countless Buddhas, great bodhisattvas, heavenly beings, here we have Bodhisattva, the delusive wisdom, as a relative nobody. He's way far away, right? Under the earth, countless lands, far away. And I think he represents you and me. Nobody special. We're all just beginner bodhisattvas. So, the great Manjushri is bested by nobody special. Or is he? The koan does not tell us how Manjushri responded. Perhaps he laughed at his own failure. Perhaps he congratulated delusive wisdom. Perhaps success and failure never crossed his mind. Perhaps he saw that he and delusive wisdom are part of a greater whole, both offering their wisdom and compassion, both of the same source. I'm going to read to you now a poem, a kind of poetic commentary by added much later to the koan by a Chinese Zen teacher named Langya. Here's the poem. The woman, Manjushri, delusive wisdom. Ultimately, how do Zen followers understand? Only if you harmonize subtly, beyond convention, will you believe the waves are basically water. the waves are basically water. What is success? What is failure? So, let us resolve, my dear Dharma friends, to fail better, to cultivate the ability to hold the rawness of our vulnerability in each of our hearts. And let us see our failures, or what we call our failures, as simply connection to other human beings, as simply part of what it means to be alive. And maybe with time we can make an offering of our failures to this world. So here's a koan. Maybe hold for a few days. Meeting failure as a good teacher. How do I respond? Meeting failure as a good teacher. How do I respond? Well, thank you for lending me your ear. And again, thank you for coming, for showing up on such a beautiful day. It really does warm my heart to see you all in your little squares. And I hope before long to see you in the flesh, in the zendo, over coffee, tea, munching on cookies. Thank you.